Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Brodesch. She is Marjorie. And I just want to say one word to you. One word. Are you listening? Plastics. That's a historical reference. You have to figure out. That's right. Credit cards, debit cards, cards dedicated to specific retail stores are all displacing cash. Our economy is also going electric, rendering bills and coins pretty much the stuff of really small daily transactions. So are we headed to a cashless society? And if so, do we stand to gain or lose? Here with us to take on this question and others is Harvard historian Nancy Kane. Nancy is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book, Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Hello, Nancy.
Hey there.
Hi, Nancy. So do we gain or lose? And what about the small businesses that Jeff McCormick was just talking about? How do they fare in a cashless society?
You know, I was driving over here thinking about what's the historical analog to this, right? If you think about the history of money or, you know, mediums of exchange. And I was thinking about the early days of banknotes in America, which really is the late 18th and particularly the first three or four decades of the 19th century. And you know, there are some broad similarities here, right? There were all kinds of alternatives, as there are today in mobile or cashless payments. There was lots of fraud. Think about Target or Target, right, last year.
Target. I love it.
There was lots of, I would say, household or small business dubiosity, you know, doubt and and fear about this. So in that sense, again, we don't really have something completely brand new, but in the end, paper money became much more important than gold or specie. Paper money became much more important than trading, you know, eggs and butter or fresh vegetables for calico and lemon drops and panes of glass for your log cabin. And I think we will see that happen here too, that a new and improved credit card. Remember, credit cards are pretty new. There was no Visa or MasterCard until the very late 1950s and early 1960s.
Was Diners Club the first thing?
I believe Diners Club was the first thing. What there were, and here we go down a historical memory lane, what there were department store credit cards.
Oh, right.
So
right.
Estee Lauder, when she first set out selling her cold creams and lipstick and, you know, what would become eyeshadow and ultimately perfume, wanted to be in department stores in the 50s because there's the same reason why merchants want to accept credit cards, right, and are willing to pay what they consider extortionate fees to places like Visa and MasterCard. She wanted to sell in department stores because she knew that women making spontaneous decisions in store about whether to buy a lipstick as well as a mascara were much more likely to do that if they didn't have to have cash because they'd have more, in effect, spending power.
That's
so her first points of distribution, she was so brilliant, were department stores. And then, lo and behold, crank the time clock forward, in the early 60s come credit cards, universal credit cards. We used to be MasterCharge for any of our listeners that remember that far back.
Sure.
And then Visa, which I think was something before it was Visa. And, of course, Amex and Diners Club. And so, you know, the evolution of a cashless society was gradual with spurts of more, you know, rapid speed. And here we are now in not only a moment when we're talking very seriously about in the age of the internet and hackers and all kinds of ways of breaking into financial systems, new and improved technology, such as what they use in Europe called pin and chip technology.
Which is going to cost retailers a lot less money. They'll have to pay less money, less of that 70-some billion dollars to the credit card companies, right?
Absolutely.
So,
goes the theory. So what Jim is talking about is $74 billion was effectively spent in credit card fees. This isn't the fees that our listeners paid when they were, if they happened to be a day late with Visa. These are fees that, you know, Target or Macy's or, you know, the Legal Seafoods actually had to pay
processing fees
somewhere on average between 2.5% and 3.5% of every transaction, mostly to what folks like, you know, the head of the National Retail, a man in the National Retail Federation calls the duopoly, meaning a two-actor monopoly of Visa and MasterCard, who in some sense hold the keys to the Golden Kingdom on this. So $74 billion. So the argument goes that if we have a much more safe technology where you have to enter a PIN to use your Visa, whether it's at a restaurant or a gas station, you know, or online, then credit card companies, Visa, MasterCard, Diners Club, Amex, will have to spend a lot less on security because this technology, which is widely used in Europe, is much more effective. So, you know, Visa and MasterCard haven't come out and said, yeah, we are looking forward to embracing this and lowering fees. So I wouldn't hold our breath on this, but the theory is very, very sound. And certainly we want to move towards something, given how much of our daily transactions are done in credit cards, we want to move to something that is more secure.
You know, Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School, you said something before about Estee Lauder realizing, and she was a genius in so many ways, that women would buy the lipstick and the mascara, the lipstick and the perfume if they were using the department store card as opposed to cash. And it is so true. I want to know what the psychology – I mean, one of my kids graduated from college this weekend and we went out for an expensive meal. Of course, I put it on the credit card. If I had to hand out $200 in cash, I would have killed myself. But I just handed over the credit card. Exactly. It was no. What is that about?
So I think a huge amount of that is about the increasing, and it clearly is increasing over time. When I say time, over say the last three generations, four generations of consumption, the increasing power of spontaneous, what we call in the trade point of sale decision making. Oh yes, you're in Radio Shack or you're in the Apple Store buying accessories now. You know, because our computers have become like Barbie, right? We buy lots of accessories for our toys, and you think, oh yes, I think I will add on some of those incredibly expensive sheets of plastic that cover your iPhone and protect them. And by the way, let's get a new cover. And oh, I think, yes, a new kind of keyboard for my Mac, for my iPad, because it's getting a little dirty. You would never do that. You'd be much less likely to do that if you were carrying around, you know, a wad of bills that was only so thick and you had to count it out. Or if you had your checkbook there and you're paying by check and you're looking at your bank balance.
Yes.
We are so self-delusional.
But
it
why?
Is, it
this
is
about, it is. It is about a kind of game, a set of fantasies, that tapes that we roll through our heads about what we can spend. And remember, we were talking last week about the financial crisis and household responsibility around indebtedness. Credit card debt, other than mortgage debt, credit card debt is by far and away the biggest source of household indebtedness. And so
college tuition's right up there too, but
well,
those are the
sure,
big three.
But, but I mean, if you think about the kind of big components of household spending and where we accumulate IOUs on it, we accumulate an enormous amount at much higher interest rates than on student loans in credit
Very
card debt, right? And so, yes, I think we play a set of games that aren't necessarily so healthy for our long-term peace of mind and financial household security.
By the way, just to put this in context, Marjorie and I are reading something this morning. 80% of U.S. consumer transactions are electronic, and it's increasing. But my favorite story, in Sweden, 97% are electronic. And listen to this. The decline in cash use in Sweden has become so pronounced that homeless people have been given card readers by something called Situation Stockholm. So when they sell newspapers, like what's that, the spare change, like spare change, they can process the payment. You know, the reason why credit cards are so dangerous, in my estimation, is because of what you and Marjorie just discussed, the self-delusion. So then a lot of us said, well, debit cards are better because it isn't revolving. You have to pay it right away if you don't have the money. It's a little less painful than cash. But the reality is, what is amazing to me, and I'm one of the people who is doing what I can't believe. It used to be I wouldn't pay for a cup of coffee with a debit card. I was too embarrassed to the people. Now I pay for everything with a debit card. But I'm aware of what happened at Target. I'm aware of all this hacking. Why don't people like me say we should be going in the opposite direction? We know it's easy. We know it's self-delusional. But it is really dangerous. We should be spending cash wherever we can. So why is this trend as moving as quickly as it is, despite the evidence that it's risky?
The answer is, your point is dead on, and it isn't, actually.
Isn't
because it isn't moving like a train, you know, without brakes toward cashless society.
80% of transactions are electronic,
well,
even in the
U.S. Hold 80% of counted transactions. So I went back at Chelsea Mertz, your superstar producer's urging, went back to a James Sierowiecki New Yorker article, for those of you that are interested, August 29th, 2013, about the underground economy in America. So the estimates range from somewhere between about $400 billion and $2 trillion worth of transactions. That's a big hunk of GDP, folks. It's a big hunk of that.
What is it? What is it?
Stay with me. Are cash and not counted. So we call it the underground economy. Uh-huh. Most of this is wages. Wages that my general contractor pays in cash to folks he's just got work in a day or two. Wages that folks pay to nannies, barber, haircuts.
Like those people that tried to get on the Supreme Court of the United States. What, like Zoe Baird or whoever it was years ago ran afoul of not paying their Social Security taxes?
I suspect
taxes.
That every single one of us has some little story to tell.
Marjorie has, yes.
Maybe only one,
not
maybe
me.
More.
Oh, no.
But folks, It turns out that best estimates say American households are sitting on $750 billion worth of cash. So that's a lot of money that's being in small – it's all in small dosage, mm-hmm. right? It's, oh, here's some tips for the gentleman that parks my car at school events, right?
Oh, yes.
Here's money for teachers at the end of the year. And lots of it is happening in a very regular way because of two things. One – right, the changing nature of work and all the outsourcing and contracting and freelancing and the brave new, frightening or perhaps liberating, depending on how you think about it, world of non-W-2, non-benefits mm-hmm. provided work. And two, it's happening because there's lots and lots of people, particularly in the sort of top decile or top quartile of the income distribution, depend on people that actually prefer to be paid in cash. And you ask why? Well, people distrust the government, right? People do not want small business, some small businesses included. My general contractor might indeed prefer not to have to file all the documents, right, on payroll and just pay, say, his masons or his floor layers on cash here and there.
And not pay taxes, too.
So at the same time that we see this counted, legitimate, you know, recognized embrace of cashless transactions, there's a lot of cash greasing people's palms, some in regular, some in infrequent and occasional ways, but it's a lot of money.
But, you know, one of the things that was pretty scary in a piece I read in anticipation of your coming here, Nancy, was this whole government pressure on places like Visa and MasterCard to do things like banning online gambling payments from their systems. And they were saying, is it really too far-fetched to wonder if a day might come when, say, somebody with a weight problem would find that any sugary drink purchase they make through a credit card or debit card could be declined? Does that sound nuts to you?
Well, I mean, it sounds like it's in the solar system of the worries about all kinds of privacy and government and other kinds of oversight. That's what it sounds to me like, right? And one of the things that we are, in effect, giving up when we say it's just so much more convenient never to carry cash, never to have to, and the delusions we can play around that, if we want to call them that, is we're giving up the idea, and go back to the people that are taking cash and are paying cash, we're giving up the idea that somehow what we do is our own business. It is not our own business. It is a whole lot of people's business, right? Just like your search history on the internet, your search history, right?
We just spoke to the producer of a Frontline documentary tonight, talking about how Silicon Valley cooperated with the NSA to tell government everything about us. So that was an hour ago.
I rest my case. You know, yeah. QED, right? Your search history is fair game. So is the transaction history of, you know, the cup of you know, coffee you just bought at Starbucks with your debit card or your Visa.
We only have a minute plus left. About 5 years ago, we were talking to Barney Frank on the radio, and right before he started screaming at me for being a moron, me, not him, which is practically every interview I've done with Barney Frank in the last 20 years.
Me too.
I said to him, because he was chair of the Financial Services Committee, why do you guys not in a small way, why do you not put a cap on credit card interest rates? I would vote for Donald Sterling as president of the United States, maybe not. I mean,
it's usury.
Why does Congress
why do
not
we allow
say,
usury?
Okay, it
yes,
used to be 24,
exactly.
What is it, 18, whatever the cap is now, it is usury. Why do members of Congress not say the cap is 6%? You're only going to make $42 trillion next year instead of $84 trillion. Why is there not a move to put a cap? We sadly have about 45 seconds.
Okay, so I'm just going to go back to last week's show and Tim Geithner, and I don't know how many of our listeners saw Paul Krugman's excoriating column about very, very carefully written, I might add, about Geithner's kindness to the banks, right? Mm-hmm. Wall Street instead of Main Street. There's evidence, you know, that supports that. I think some of it is about the power of these large banks. I mean, this is huge
Dick
business.
Dick Durbin say the banks own Congress.
This is the huge. This is a huge
Senator
business. It's an easy. It's an annuity, right? Every transaction, that little bit gets skimmed off. Yeah. And when we're talking about trillions of dollars worth of transactions, we're talking about billions and billions of dollars of easy, you know, easy weight to the falling directly to the bottom line. I think that's a big piece of it. I should add, just because Barney Frank's on our lips and in our minds, that the Dodd-Frank bill actually ironically allows merchants to charge a two-tiered system. That's why at gas stations now, you get a discount if you pay cash.
I hate that.
So do most consumers.
Okay, Nancy Kane.
Nancy joins us every Tuesday for Open Mic. She's an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Thank you guys for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow, Global Post Charlie Sennett on international news, and TV's Bob Thompson also joins us. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, Amanda McGowan on our team are our team, and John Parker is our engineer. I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thanks for tuning in. Please tune in again tomorrow.